us at the end of the day, because we're the Rockefeller Foundation, we have to make sure that every investment is a good quality investment. When we invest in something, the world pays attention.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Clean Techies Podcast. Today we have a really, really cool episode. We had the opportunity to speak with Thomas Belazes from the legendary Rockefeller Foundation. Thomas is the Director of Innovative Finance Team at Rockefeller Foundation, which can be characterized as the foundation's impact investing and climate investing arm. Given the history of the foundation being one of the first formalized and well-organized philanthropic funds created over 100 years ago, this was really an honor. And specifically, I'm a big fan of history broadly, so this for me was really, really special, getting to speak with somebody who represents a fund that is really, really kind of monumental in this space. Some of the notable things we covered today are how the foundation is going all in on climate, how the foundation is often a moment of kind of catalytic capital, where once they invest, other people are more interested, or kind of it unlocks capital for a particular investment class or space, and why it's so important that they ensure each investment is of high integrity because of the weight their name carries. Enjoy this episode with Thomas from the Rockefeller Foundation. Oh, and one last thing. Before we get to the episode, if you haven't already, please take a moment to fill out our listener survey. It only takes a few minutes, but it really, really helps us tailor the show to your liking. Thank you so much.
All right, Thomas, welcome to the show. How are you?
Doing well. How about you all?
Doing great. Philanthropy and climate is a huge topic right now. We just had another episode recorded on this. It will be out by the time this episode is out on this same topic. So really excited to have you on. Please, Thomas, introduce yourself. What is your quick one-liner for the audience?
Yeah. Thanks again for having me. My name's Thomas Belazes. I'm a director on the innovative finance team at the Rockefeller Foundation, which you could effectively characterize as a foundation's impact investing climate investment arm.
Shout out to our sponsors, Net Zero Insights. Net Zero Insights' mission is to enable the transition to a sustainable future by giving decision makers access to the leading market intelligence platform on climate innovation. Through the Net Zero platform, Net Zero Insights provides high-quality data and insights on the climate tech venture market by being the best at tracking organizations and funding rounds. I personally have had a great time using this to prepare for the podcast and researching companies, funding rounds, VCs, and the latest I need to know about the climate tech ecosystem. Use the link in our description to schedule your personalized demo with the team and claim your 10% discount. Thanks again to the Net Zero Insights team for sponsoring this show.
Innovative finance, a lot of buzzwords there, like really, really, really exciting ones, though, especially in philanthropy. I want to set the stage. The Rockefeller Foundation announced its new climate strategy in a letter from Dr. Rajiv Shah on September 14th about the Rockefeller Foundation going all in on climate. And this was really exciting because this was announced ahead of New York Climate Week, where myself and now formerly Silas was based. So this was really, really big for us. And the first thing I want to do is just start with a quote on what he said, which was, and I quote, "Moving forward, we will leverage every part of our foundation, including our resources, convenings, and voice, to help transform the four systems that are essential to the well-being of people and the planet." So you were at the Rockefeller Foundation while this was both happening and then officially launched. What was it like being there before this announcement and then now seeing all of the change?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for one, this is super exciting. I think going into this discussion, it's important to maybe provide just a little bit of history on the Rockefeller Foundation. So the Rockefeller Foundation was founded in 1913, and I think it's one of the oldest, if not the oldest, major philanthropy in the United States and perhaps in the world. And ironically, we were founded on the back of oil money, right? It was John D. Rockefeller's money that was granted to the foundation. And over the course of our 110-year history, our work has always really been centered around humanitarian causes. The mission of the foundation is actually to promote the well-being of humanity. And so human beings have always been sort of at the center of our work. And over the course of that 110-year history, there have been some really impactful work that have been funded over the course of the last century. We helped launch the Green Revolution. We funded a whole series of breakthroughs in science. We funded a lot of the major vaccines, including yellow fever. But climate was never really sort of a focus point for the organization. We certainly had programs that focused on the environment and different aspects of climate change, but it was never really the centerpiece of what the foundation was set up to do. And so fast forward to 2022, we as an organization came together and basically came to the realization that climate change is not just a GHG or gigaton impact issue. It's also a humanitarian issue. And if we don't do something as an organization to help address the fight against climate change, all of that amazing humanitarian work that we had done over the course of the last century will likely be fundamentally undermined. And so that's why Rockefeller decided to take such a big step into this space. And that's why we're putting such a, that's why we're making such a large commitment.
We are excited to announce that we have launched a Patreon. You can find this newly linked in our Substack and audio platform descriptions. We are both really just so grateful for each and every one of you and wanted to create a way to interact with you and for you to support us on our journey as we continue and try to talk to the best people doing amazing things in climate tech. We do all of this on the time we can muster outside of our day jobs, so any support means the world. Now, gushing over, back to the show.
That's really great. And I think part of it was the announcement that was given following that on September 15th announced $1 billion towards climate solutions as part of the Rockefeller Foundation's first ever five-year plan. Could you walk us through the high-level overview of what this is about?
So yeah, so we announced a $1 billion commitment to climate, which basically means that we're going to be putting $1 billion to work over the course of the next 5 years, which is quite significant for us. Just to put it into perspective, we as an organization spend somewhere between $200 and $300 million a year. So that basically means that we're going to be putting about 75% of our resources towards some type of climate aligned initiative. So quite significant. I think before that, we were probably putting maybe 25% or less of our resources towards anything related to climate. And before making this announcement, you know, all of our teams were basically charged with trying to think through what climate means for them. And we have programs that span across energy, food and agriculture, health, U.S. equity and economic opportunity, and data technology. And for some of those programs, climate is very much at the center of what they do. For others, maybe it's a little bit more on the periphery. But at the end of the day, you know, everyone is thinking in a very substantial way around what climate means for them. And this goes beyond just our program teams. This also feeds into our operations. We announced, we made our net zero announcement, which is really exciting. And even our endowment has actually committed to decarbonizing, which was really a landmark announcement. I think the Rockefeller Endowment is probably the largest endowment in the country to have made a net zero commitment. So really this, you know, this new strategy is really spanning across every aspect of our operations.
So now going off of that, you have announced this large amount of capital. It's based on a lot of things. One of the things that I'd love to dive into just as a high level, the net zero commitment. What is that and why is that innovative?
Well, for one, you know, I think as a philanthropy, it's really important for us to sort of eat our own dog food and to really sort of set the standard for what it means to be driving high integrity, high quality impact. So for us, you know, with all of the major corporates moving towards net zero, we thought there was no excuse for a foundation like us to make a similar commitment. And our emissions really aren't that great, aren't that large. You know, I think the biggest source of emissions for us is travel. So nothing compared to a lot of the major corporates. I think what's also really interesting about that is I think we were probably one of the first major foundations to make a net zero commitment. And so on the back of that, a lot of our peers ended up following suit, and a lot of similar organizations in philanthropy or development finance or civil society, I think, are also following suit. So in some sense, I think there was kind of a catalytic effect in making that.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I think one of the most important parts of this is that it fundamentally operates almost like an investment strategy. So one thing I'd love to hear are, what are the big things that you're looking at within the space specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be clear, so we have our program teams, right? So of the $200-300 million that I mentioned in sort of annual spend, about 90% of that is pure philanthropic grant funding. And then you have our team, which is basically, you know, our team is the investment team that is not the endowment, that is making investments across three different prongs or three different objectives. We invest for financial return, we invest for impact return, and then we also invest for catalytic return, which I can go into later in the discussion. And our team has been around for a long time, and we can get into the history of the team and you know, the work that we've done over the last 20 years. But alongside this big announcement and big commitment that the foundation decided to make, we also thought it was important that we incorporate finance investing into that commitment. And why is that important? If we think about the climate crisis from a capital markets perspective, I think the latest report that McKinsey published at the end of last year suggested a $41 trillion financing gap to reach our 2030 net zero goals, right? That is a very big number. And even if McKinsey is only 50% right, that's a lot of capital that needs to be deployed over the course of a very short amount of time. And so that's a very daunting task for the capital markets. The positive of all of that is that there is, you know, we've reached this extraordinary moment in time where the entire world is moving towards net zero, right? Including a foundation like us. And as a result of that, I think the latest number suggests around, call it like over $100 trillion in balance sheet that's sitting on the sidelines, committed to investing in climate solutions in service of net zero, in service of net zero goals. The problem here is that there's the capital that's sitting on the sidelines that does not necessarily match the projects that are on the ground. And so that's basically where we come into play, because there's a need for groups like Rockefeller or an Elemental Accelerator, or even the major corporates out there. There's a need for major groups out there that are willing to provide sort of that early funding to essentially gin up the pipeline of investable solutions that to eventually make their way into the portfolios of large-scale institutional investors, whether it be pension funds, whether it be endowments like the Rockefeller Endowment, whether it be sovereign wealth funds. That's the capital that we ultimately need to unlock if we want to fill this $41 trillion financing gap. So that's why our strategy was launched in the first place. And that's kind of our reason to be. And so over the course of the last 18 months, we've basically been building out a pilot portfolio to think through what this strategy could potentially look like at scale. Investing across two very high level topics. One is nature-based climate solutions, which, you know, I think is a relatively underrepresented and overlooked part of the market. And then, you know, decarbonization or more classic kind of climate tech solutions. And thinking, not only thinking about how we scale those solutions and deploy them faster, but also thinking about how we can leverage those solutions to also impact human beings and also deliver development outcomes alongside climate outcomes. So that's sort of the strategy from a very, very high level, sort of 1,000-foot view.
Yeah, this is great. I'm glad we're getting to the topic of nature-based solutions. This is something that's come up quite often in my discussions over the past year. I've gotten the chance to work on a couple nature-based solution searches, and I'm just really, I guess, curious to see in that light of funding projects before they're kind of, you know, let's call them traditional private equity investable or investment ready. What do they look like at this point? Because a lot of people, you know, I bring up how cool nature-based solutions are and how much money they're going to save, cities and states. And they're always like, I don't understand it. So can you give us some examples of what that actually looks like in real life?
Yeah, the nature-based solutions market is becoming ever defined. And I think we take a pretty broad view of what that looks like. So for us, what we've been looking at over the course of the last year and a half is everything from market-oriented models that drive conservation or restoration, or thinking about more agriculture plays and thinking about land use and thinking about how we actually use that land more productively and in a more climate positive way. And so, and then there's also the ocean, right? You could think about, seaweeds or coral reef protection. There's, you know, all sorts of sort of what I would call hybrid solutions like nature-based carbon removal, like enhanced rock weathering. So you can take a pretty broad view of what a nature-based solution is. Just to give you an example, one of our first major deals was actually into a reforestation developer in Brazil. And so what this team does, and this to me is kind of like the sweet spot for where we like to play in the market. This company was founded by two of Brazil's probably most prominent entrepreneurs over the course of the last 10 years, call it. The CEO was the former CEO of Brazil's first unicorn. The CFO was a former CFO of Nubank. And they both banded together to create a company that was focused on climate change. And the model is very simple. Basically, what they do is they either buy or they lease land on the fringes of the Amazon. They reforest it with 90 different native diverse species. And then they sell carbon credits on the back of that reforestation. And they do that in a way that is rooted in significant scientific rigor. They have one of Brazil's top scientists that has written like over 150 papers on reforestation alongside the head of forestry from Brazil's largest pulp and paper company, who has probably done more reforestation than, you know, 99% of the people in Brazil. And so you bring that together and suddenly you have a combination that is super powerful. And so we invested in their first pool of projects, which was $100 million financing that brought in actually some pretty commercial players like CPPIB, Bain Capital, AXA's Natural Capital Fund. And the most recent milestone that we're really excited about is they actually signed a $75 million offtake agreement with Microsoft, which is the largest nature-based, at the time at least, was the largest nature-based offtake agreement of carbon to date. So that, I think, is a really interesting example, because you have a strong team trying to do something really ambitious, and with some early capital from a foundation like Rockefeller, if they can prove out what they're doing, then this is a model that could ultimately make its way into the portfolio of a Brookfield or one of these major pension funds.
So broadly speaking, the main value add is that these ideas are just ideas. They're not truly proven in the world. And basically the private equity is uncomfortable with it. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's lots of different ways in which you could kind of think about it. One is through what we call demonstration projects. So whether it's companies or technologies or other sort of new concepts in the market that no one's actually seen before, and they need some capital to prove themselves out. And once proven, then private equity comes and follows on. There's a lot of talk around, you know, first of a kind climate solutions and the need for capital to just create a track record for different types of climate technologies, because major infrastructure funds aren't going to invest in that technology until you've maybe done, you know, 5 to 10 projects. Sometimes it's just a function of deployments. If you look at emerging markets, for example, and a lot of the markets in which the foundation operates, it's less a function of actually proving out a technology and more a function of just getting that technology deployed in that market. And someone basically needs to gin up the pipeline of projects to start scaling up deployments in a part of the world that, you know, institutional investors haven't necessarily gone before, at least within the asset class. So there's a whole host of ways in which you could think about our capital or similar capital and how we might think about our sort of catalytic role.
I'm kind of curious, do you have any particular stats on, you mentioned there's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines. How valuable is doing, you know, a project that Rockefeller helps with to get it proven? And how much more money does that unlock once you've done that? I mean, there's got to be some type of multiple there.
So our Zero Gap Fund, which is kind of like our flagship impact fund, that fund is fully invested. And to date, we have tracked about 34 times our money catalyzed. So it was a small fund. It was only a $30 million fund, but there was about, you know, I don't know, do the math there. Like over $1 billion of capital that was catalyzed on the back of our $30 million. And so one might argue that was a pretty good use of funding.
Are there particular ways in which you ensure quality? Like say, for example, if it's a proven technology in a new market or an emerging market, does the Rockefeller Foundation have specific ability to ensure the outcomes are positive, and that's why other people are willing to co-invest with you?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of our biggest value additions in this market. If you think about the carbon markets, for example, where there is a lot of skepticism, right, around what high impact and high quality really means, or what a good project really means, the market is constantly looking to groups like Rockefeller, for example, who can help developers think through what that looks like. And so for us, if we're going to invest in a carbon project, we're going to do a ton of due diligence on that project to make sure that it's a solid project. We're going to work with the developer to make sure that the way they're thinking about impact measurement and monitoring is best in class. But we're finding that role in and of itself is quite catalytic. You know, a lot of groups are wanting to partner with us just because the signaling around what we stand for and our ability to sort of help steer the market towards what is high impact and what is not has been quite catalytic.
In your experience, especially as, even though it is a small portion, philanthropic capital has grown in climate and the influence specifically within the philanthropy space has risen over the past decade. Last episode that we discussed this, we talked a little bit about science-based philanthropies and the new coalition that had come about and this excitement behind it. I'm curious, a big part of that is, like you said, partnering and teamworking and being a good player within the system. How are you often either approached or received as a philanthropy in this space? Some positives maybe that you seem benign and not as aggressive perhaps as a funder, but you may also have questions about your legitimacy in terms of knowledge. I'm not insinuating that those are the circumstances, but what is that experience like?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think there's a lot of confusion in the market around my team specifically, because we are kind of in this in-between space. And I don't think people, you know, especially within the world of maybe climate tech, where philanthropies are, you know, climate tech maybe has been more government funded. Perhaps philanthropies are newer kids on the block. I'm a little bit unclear, but I think a lot of people think about the world in terms of grants and investment and nothing in between. And so oftentimes people will come to our team asking for a grant, which, you know, we do have a little bit of grant funds, but that's not really the core of our business. There is a little bit of confusion and sort of market education that we're constantly trying to supersede around, you know, what we have to offer as an investment team, which at the end of the day, you know, we're going to be looking at our deals very commercially. You know, we're going to hold all of our transactions to the highest degree of underwriting standards, not only from a commercial perspective, but also from an impact perspective. But we also recognize that, you know, we're investing off the back of Rockefeller's philanthropic balance sheet. And so that we do have the opportunity to structure our deals maybe a little bit more creatively, invest in more pioneering ideas. So there's a role for us in the market, but we have to be very careful about that role, because we want to make sure that we're being good investors, that we're applying good judgment, that we're not necessarily distorting markets. You know, it requires a little bit of investor education, because I just think there's a lot of nuance, I suppose, around how we might think about the world.
And I think that investor education, that's almost a perfect segue. I feel like the diligence component of it is probably undersold. Oftentimes funds who have very strong diligence processes often end up being leads for different rounds, but it's not always understood what about that diligencing process is so remarkable. And I think that's a very niche point that great funds like yourself or great capital groups like yourself really do pride themselves on. So you said it a few times, I'd love to dive into it, you know, really quick. Why do you think there's such a high emphasis on diligence, and where does it come from?
You know, it's almost incumbent on us to make sure that every deal is a high quality deal, because we know when we invest in something, the world pays attention. That's not to say that we don't rely on others' diligence. In fact, we think that there's a lot of investors out there that are way smarter than us. And we actually like investing with partners who might have the technical chops to underwrite, a forestry deal or a technology that we don't understand. So we like bringing partners to the table that can fill knowledge gaps in the diligence process. But we also want to make sure that the company or the fund or the project that we're investing in is sufficiently vetted.
Yeah. One other thing that we kind of discussed in our, I guess, pre-call would be your ability to invest flexibly. So can you talk about that? I'm assuming that's specifically referring to your group within the fund, but can you talk about why you're able to invest in a flexible manner and why it's important?
So as I mentioned before, you know, we're investing, our capital comes from several different sleeves. Most of it comes from our programmatic balance sheet. So it's not coming from the endowment, which has a separate sort of fiduciary responsibility. It comes off our programmatic balance sheet. And we do have a separate fund that we manage that does have some fiduciary nuance to it, but that's a separate story. But at the end of the day, given the capital that we invest, given where our capital comes from, it does give us the ability to think about risk in a slightly different way relative to, a pension fund that just may be bound by certain return requirements that make it very difficult for them to invest in certain assets or certain areas. So we think that is a very powerful tool to bring to bear to the market. In a market that has such a significant financing gap, we believe that that's a very powerful tool in basically finding ideas, whether it's new funds or other types of climate solutions that we think are really kind of on the tipping point of institutional adoption. So with some capital from Rockefeller, if we can invest in this thing and push it over the edge, it'll ultimately make its way up the J curve into institutional adoption. And that's a very, that's a very scarce resource in the market. It's a very scarce resource, and it's a very powerful resource. So having that flexibility is very important. Beyond that, we can provide capital solutions that basically meet the needs of whoever we're investing in. So, a lot of people talk about blended finance. So we could potentially invest in the equity or the mezzanine tranche of a deal, and that might provide sufficient de-risking to bring in a bunch of senior capital. We're not necessarily bound by a specific asset class or a specific instrument. So the ability to have that type of flexibility to sort of fit the needs of different projects, I think, is quite powerful.
Yeah, no, I think that's quite interesting, given especially that there's a lot of, you know, uncharted waters within climate. So that's quite fascinating. I do want to go back a bit. So, you know, we're talking about all these things, but we never really talked about how did you get here? Like, what's your journey to making it into the Rockefeller Foundation in this particular role?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good question. I guess a little background on me. I mean, I'm currently sitting in New York, and I've been living in New York longer than I can probably count at this point, which probably makes me a quasi New Yorker. But I actually grew up in the Midwest. I'm a Rust Belt kid, and I grew up in a, you know, somewhat multicultural family. And I actually had parents who sort of carved out their own impact career. You know, my dad was a poverty lawyer. My mom was a nurse. And I don't think I necessarily realized it at the time, but, you know, that I think served as a pretty significant inspiration for me in thinking about what I wanted to do when I eventually grew up, not knowing what that was. And when I was in college, I had a lot of just through my family upbringing, I had a lot of international curiosity, and I studied in Luxembourg. I did internships in Chile and Tunisia. And then when I graduated, I decided to go into the business world, which almost gave my dad a heart attack. You know, when I just got out of college, I had a short stint on Wall Street. And shortly thereafter, I landed an opportunity with a consulting firm actually based in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And that was in 2010, 2011, during the commodities boom, when Brazil was really thriving. And so the company I was working for, we were consulting for like the big companies like Vale, which at the time were expanding pretty aggressively internationally. So I was working on a whole host of international expansion projects through that experience. And that was definitely very eye-opening for me. And when I came back to the States, I decided that I wanted to transition into investing. And so I came back to New York, and I worked for a hedge fund, private equity fund, that did both public equity investing in emerging markets and then some kind of lower middle market buyouts in the U.S., and which was a very different experience from my impact investing roles. You know, very much kind of like the cutthroat sort of hedge fund culture. And that was probably around 2012. And around that time, that's when I started learning about this brand new sort of novel idea called impact investing. I think I got coffee with a friend, and he had mentioned it to, you know, he had mentioned this new idea to me. And the more I learned about it, the more I realized that this was like the perfect intersection of the experiences that I was accumulating professionally, the experiences that I accumulated personally, and sort of like the, I don't know, manifest destiny for what I might potentially want to be when I grow up. And so I decided, you know, I think this is what I want to do.
What specifically about your time, you mentioned there was a couple of things that were eye-opening during your time in Brazil. What was eye-opening that caused you to go into investment? And did you seek something else outside of investing before you ended up making that choice?
Yeah, the experience in Brazil, I mean, for one, I think every professional should have some type of international experience. You know, I think it's, you know, one of the most enriching experiences someone can have is to do business in another country, in another culture. Having the opportunity, well, for one, having the opportunity to work in an emerging market sort of made me fall in love with the opportunity in emerging markets, and I suppose the problems that one could potentially solve in emerging markets, that there actually is opportunity to perhaps leverage the private sector and, you know, more market and business oriented solutions to driving development. And when I was in Brazil, you were kind of seeing it firsthand because Brazil was growing like 9% a year at that time. You know, I think just through that experience, I sort of developed a passion for the emerging markets and, you know, being a consultant and kind of being more at the company or operator level, I thought was really interesting. But I wanted to kind of use that experience to see if I could drive value at the investor level.
And at what point, so you mentioned something that I guess kind of resonated a bit with me, which is, you know, you got to a point where you learned about impact investing and it seemed like almost like the stars aligned. You realize, oh man, this is what I've been, this kind of lines up with everything that I've been doing and it makes me a really good fit for this. Can you just talk about maybe some of the challenges of going through that part, maybe this kind of part of your career where you may not have felt, hey, is this the right thing ultimately? But then in the end, it kind of led you to where you needed to be, because I believe there's a lot of people, especially in their early career, who are just uncertain if they're in the right place. I mean, you mentioned your family upbringing and you may have had an underlying thing saying, ah, I don't know if this is the right thing for me to be doing, going in the cutthroat hedge fund world and then eventually moving into this world. Can you just talk about that experience and maybe some of the key thoughts you have for other people who may be uncertain if they're on the right track currently?
Yeah. So one thing that I have come to realize in life is that I don't think you'll ever, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I feel like there's never certainty around whether you're on the right track. And so for me, you know, and we'll see if it pans out. But I was more focused on following my interests than anything else. Because I think, especially when you're in your early 20s, there's just a whole host of confusion around what you should be doing and, you know, where you should be, and you're constantly going through an identity crisis. But, you know, if I were to give kind of one piece of advice, I think it would be, I would focus less on what your friends are doing and what other people are doing and what other people think you should be doing, and more thinking about, you know, from the bottom of your heart, like if you think about sort of that gut feeling around where your passions are, I think that's the best guidance that you can give yourself. So when it came to making a lot of decisions in my life, I'm sure there was a mixture of peer pressure and doing things that I thought were interesting. But I think at the end of the day, following what I thought I would ultimately be passionate about, I think is what ultimately led to later success.
I think this is quite fascinating. This is something I've heard many, many people mention in their career journeys when asked on panels. Like, it's a super common theme. And a lot of people say, oh, you know, following your passions, that sounds so stupid, it sounds so corny, whatever. But I think it's very true, right? If you look at people who are happy in the work they do, that's kind of what led them there. I do want to ask one other key thing too, which is a lot of people end up having mentors that kind of play a role in their career journey. Do you have any specific people that played that role for you, and why were they important?
Yeah, I've definitely accumulated mentors over the years. I don't know if I want to name any names on this podcast, but I think in my early career in particular, I worked with some really impressive investment professionals that I think taught me almost everything that I know today. And I still leverage those individuals as mentors. I think I was really lucky in having gotten exposure to some pretty senior people in my early career who could sort of help me chart. There was enough runway between me and them to help think through the pathway and think through different decisions. But yeah, I think I was very fortunate in my early career in having some very strong professionals that I think allowed me to sort of acquire that sort of institutional sort of fiduciary mindset to apply that to my day-to-day today.
I think the whole point about developing that mindset and then choosing to go into it is especially relevant in climate where the paths aren't very defined for you, right? So at some point you do have to decide, hey, I've just developed either enough of an alternative skill set and I'm ready to go into climate, or you dive in kind of saying, okay, I don't know where I'm going to end up, but let me start, right? And I think, Silas, you probably see this more than anyone given recruiting. But I think that's especially relevant for people who are trying to develop some sort of climate knowledge skill set, because it really doesn't exist. It's really some subset that you're really good at. In a very bad segue, I'd love to take that idea of a subsegment that you are really knowledgeable about. One of the amazing things about philanthropies is that you get to work a lot more tangibly with carbon removal projects. And like we mentioned before, it's the idea that philanthropy can support out-of-market solutions that people won't want to back and try and make it more fundable. I want to talk about one of the most exciting things that you worked on, which is, I hope I'm not mispronouncing it, MomBac. Is that how you say it?
Yep.
So MomBac, again, sorry if I'm saying that wrong. It's a carbon removal startup based, to my understanding, in the Amazon rainforest. So what are they and how did you work with them?
So yeah, on the MomBac deal, so as I mentioned before, you know, they're a carbon removal startup focused on reforestation in the Amazon. I think for us, what was really interesting about that deal was it was less kind of the knowledge that we were bringing to the table and more the signaling that we were bringing to that specific model. Because reforestation in the Amazon, leveraging carbon credits, you know, that's a model that people haven't necessarily seen before. But it, within the context of ecological restoration, and given the maturation of the carbon markets over the course of the last 10 years, this in theory is one of the more scalable nature-based solutions out there at the moment. And so for us, we saw that opportunity and we thought it was a very exciting, we thought this is something that we should be putting our money behind. It's a really strong team that has a really impressive track record that's bringing in deep science alongside, you know, industrial grade execution and with some capital from Rockefeller to actually prove this out, we could potentially deliver a really, really significant impact. And so I think that, and that's the type of model that we feel that is not only scalable, but something that can actually take on broader capital markets adoption. Like you could see how a pension fund or an endowment might actually want to have something like this in their portfolio, because at the end of the day, you're talking about a long-term asset that would have, you know, they're basically developing long-term assets that would deliver consistent cash flows from carbon streams, basically in perpetuity. Yeah, so that's basically it. So, you know, the value that we sort of brought to that deal was more around kind of the demonstration of, you know, proving that this model is a investable model.
Another great collaboration that you've been able to see, and I think is probably one of the most exciting announcements of the Rockefeller Foundation's, I say this biasly, of the Rockefeller Foundation's work, was in late October, the announcement of their collaboration with Elemental Accelerator. And I think it is a beautiful synergy between two bodies that people see as relatively high community builders and more amicable funders in the space. So can you talk about what that was all about?
Yeah, absolutely. Really excited about the collaboration with Elemental. And no need to be shy about the bias. I think it's an amazing team. This sort of partnership came to be on the back of both our climate investment work, but also some of the programmatic work that we have here at the foundation. So we actually have a team that focuses on U.S. climate policy. And as part of that, they are actively thinking about tools like the IRA or the GGRF, and thinking about, one, how do we actually unlock that funding and deploy it faster and more efficiently? But two, how do we make sure that that funding goes to the right places? And a big part of the GGRF is thinking about climate impact alongside community impact. And so when Elemental approached us, they were in the process of putting together a portfolio of projects that were doing exactly that. Essentially, what they wanted to do was create a portfolio of demonstration projects that prove that these technologies not only deliver high climate outcomes, but could also deliver significant community impact that would meet the requirements of the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. And so for us, that was kind of the perfect, this was actually one of the few grants that we had done in our portfolio, but that was kind of the perfect marriage between, you know, what we were thinking about doing in the US around the decarbonization and scaling and deploying early stage climate technologies, and also bringing in some of the work that we're doing from the programmatic side to help influence some of the climate policies out there. So we're super excited about this partnership. You know, hopefully this is something that we can expand upon. I think there are a lot of natural synergies between our organizations in terms of how we think about the type of funding that we're looking to invest, the types of projects that we're looking to invest, and ultimately the type of impact that we're looking to have. So this is a great opportunity for us to just dip our toes in the market.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think, especially as we get to the sort of the end of this episode, one of the most important things is not only the work that you guys are doing, but it's such a recent commitment. The future is very, very promising and exciting. So I'd love to hear from your perspective, what are the most exciting things and projects to look forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's a lot that we're excited about. You know, we talked a lot about nature-based solutions, and we talked a lot about reforestation in Brazil. There's a lot, hopefully more, in the works that we'll hopefully soon be able to announce in the coming months. Regenerative agriculture is actually an area that we've been thinking a lot about. Our food team is actually doing a lot of really interesting work that is really to really drive the regenerative agriculture transition. And we've already made one investment into a venture capital fund called Trailhead Capital, which is investing in a whole host of climate technologies to support the regenerative ag transition. And we're in the process of hopefully soon closing another opportunity in the regen ag space. So that's one area where we see a lot of potential if we just think about the future of agriculture. Another area that we find to be particularly exciting is supply chain decarbonization, particularly in the emerging markets, which, so if you just think about all of these major corporates that have committed to net zero, 80% of that emissions profile is in supply chains. And so that's creating a very interesting opportunity for markets like Brazil, for example, which are massive exporters of commodities. And if you're a developer that's able to develop a commodity in a way that's carbon neutral or carbon negative, it actually creates a competitive advantage for you. And so this is a really interesting trend that we're following, because we think that this is something that's really going to revolutionize the way a lot of companies operate in different markets as major corporates start to see increasing pressure to decarbonize, whether it's voluntary or even through regulation. Like in Europe, there was some regulation that was just passed around, I think it was taxes on carbon intensive imports, which is already changing the way major corporates are thinking. So that's another category that we think is interesting.
Well, I'm curious because obviously you mentioned it several times that you do a lot of work in emerging markets. Geographically speaking, do you have particular areas that you're very interested in or excited about as, you know, in the near future, and maybe any comments around how they're developing and how they're supporting, getting other players in to support them, and you can be a catalyst in that way?
Yeah. So we realize that we can't be everywhere. We do have kind of global ambitions, but we realize we can't be everywhere. So for the time being, at least with this sort of first pot of money, we've been very much focused on opportunities in the United States and South America. South America has kind of been the hotbed for nature-based solutions, and the U.S. has been kind of the center of a lot of our work around kind of decarbonization. But as we think ahead, you know, we do want to think about markets like Asia, for example, where we have an office. We are potentially thinking about markets like Africa, where we also have an office. And I also think that there's, you know, we're a U.S. foundation, but I also think that there's a lot of really interesting things happening in Europe, particularly around all of the policy, particularly around all the policy tailwinds that you're seeing in that part of the world. But yeah, we kind of need to pick and choose where we play for the time being.
Yeah, no, even though it's the Rockefeller Foundation, they still have to be focused, right? If you spread too thin, you probably won't get much done, maybe do some bad deals. So you wouldn't want that. But this is, you know, this is really fascinating. I really do appreciate this. I just kind of highlight one thing that stood out to me when you were talking about the diligence process, to back up a little bit, was when I recall kind of reading the impetus of, not from our discussion, but reading about the impetus of where Rockefeller Foundation came from. I just recall how focused he was on quality and making sure that, you know, we do the things that are most impactful. It's very interesting to see, you know, many, many years later, how that kind of quality and focus on the right things and doing the things that are the most impactful is still carried through. So it's just a really interesting thing to note for people listening. But I really appreciate you coming on. This has been quite a pleasure to speak with you and learn from, you know, somebody doing some pretty important things in the market. Do you have any kind of final thoughts to close us out with?
Yeah. I mean, well, for one, thanks so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun recording this podcast. I would just say, you know, we are really excited to be partnering for anyone that's listening. I think one of the most interesting things about the climate space is that there are new players popping up every day, including the likes of Rockefeller, who are making billion-dollar commitments to climate. And so that's lending itself to new opportunity to work with groups that I think many investors or corporates or others in the market never perhaps thought envision themselves investing alongside of or just working alongside of in general. And so I think we're really excited about the road ahead and excited to be hopefully working with those that are listening.
Yeah, absolutely. It will be very fascinating to see how continued collaboration happens. And in particular, as it feels like there's a little bit of steam in some ways kind of coming off the sails of the climate tech movement, I really hope we see new ways of people working together, because there's a lot of people who recognize the importance of what we're doing and what we're investing in. And we want to see that momentum continue, even despite, you know, some rough patches. We don't want clean tech or climate tech 2.0 to happen. So appreciate you coming on and looking forward to being able to share this with the world.
Absolutely. Thanks again, guys.